In this talk, I want to look at the economics, sociology, and demography of marriage. The transfer of wealth at marriage is of ultimate importance in most societies. Among the Trobriands, for example, we're told by Malinowski, instead of having to buy his wife, the man receives a dowry, often relatively as tempting as that of a modern European or American heiress. This fact makes marriage among the Trobrianders a pivot of the constitution of tribal power and in the whole economic system, a pivot indeed in almost every institution. Among the Nuer, the payment or receipt of bride wealth changes a man's fortune in a very material way. Anthropologists have distinguished two major forms of marriage transfer and have looked at the functions of such transfers. One of the functions is to symbolize the transfer of rights in a person, jus in personam, that we looked at before, from one group to another, from the wife's group to the husband's. A second function is to set up a marital fund on which the young couple and their children can draw through life. And a third is as a form of compensation or indemnity to a group which has lost a member, if you've brought up a girl until the age when she is productive, and then she's gone away. You need something to fill the hole and make possible other marriages. The two major forms of marriage transfer are known as bride wealth and dowry. Let us look at these two systems. Bride wealth, also known sometimes as bride price or and associated with bride service, is a system in which there is a transfer of some kind of wealth from one group to another group. For example, among the Nuer, in one instance, 40 cattle were paid by the men's group to the lineage of the woman. 20 went, in theory, to the bride's mother's kin, 20 to the bride's father's kin, and then they are split out. So you get a payment from one group, a lineage, to another lineage to recompense them for the loss of their daughter. It is a lateral transfer that goes between groups on the same generation. It's not a form of inheritance between generations. Above all, it's the rights in the woman's procreative ability that a lineage is buying. Africans, in one famous saying, put it thus: the children are where the cattle are not. The cattle move one way, and the rights in the mother and the womb move the other way. In other words, it's the children rather than the wife which the lineage is purchasing. There's a compensation and reciprocity element. As John Beattie puts it, in patrilineal exogamous societies, bride wealth does have the character of an indemnity. By the marriage, the bride's group has lost a working member and a potential childbearer. The bride wealth is a kind of compensation for this loss. And the wealth that comes in is often used so that other members of the group, the males, can then bring in other women. The distribution of this system throughout the world has been of attention to anthropologists, and it's found that usually bride wealth is found in patrilineal societies. In matrilineal societies, John Beattie says, if bride wealth is paid at all, then it's a very small sum. And it's usually been found in pastoral societies, for example in North and East Africa, sometimes in the North American Indian societies, and in different societies it's paid in different forms, in blankets and coppers among the American Indians, in horses, sheep and camel among the Central Asian nomads. Now, dowry, which is found in different parts of the world, is a different institution. It's usually paid from an individual to an individual rather than between groups. From the father, for example, in a Greek example described by Friedel, the father has the ultimate responsibility to collect the dowry and to pass it on from the father to the daughter and her husband. It's prayed down to the bride. If there's a divorce, the wife is entitled to the return of the dower. It's a vertical transmission, therefore, between generations rather than a lateral transmission. And there's no idea of compensation or reciprocity between groups. It's the setting up of a new unit which needs a fund to get them going. That is what dowry is about. The system tends to be found in large-scale peasant societies, whereas bride wealth tends to be in pastoral, nomadic, and African societies. Dowry tends to be in settled agricultural peasant societies. For example, it was common in the Mediterranean regions and in many parts of India. And indeed, Jack Goody and others have put forward the thesis that in no African society so far uncovered does the bride bring a sizable dowry with her. Almost always the groom pays a bride price, whereas in Europe you have dowry systems. Now, the wealth transfers at marriage are one aspect of marriage. Another important matter is who marries and what proportion of people marry. Looking at the proportion, our society for some time has had a selective marriage system. That is to say, some people have married and some people haven't. Most human societies, though, have universal marriage. There are, Malinowski tells us about the Trobriands, in fact, no unmarried men of mature age except idiots, incurable invalids, old widowers, and albinos. In Moorish society, it was believed that only if you married could you go to paradise. A bachelor went to the equivalent of hell. Generally speaking, in primitive societies, there are no bachelors, or very, very few, and very few unmarried women, simply for the reason that they could not, we are told, survive. A Borro man, described by Levi-Strauss of 30, was described as unclean, ill-fed, sad, and lonesome. And the reason that Levi-Strauss was given for this was that in a society where labor is systematically shared between man and woman, where only the married status permits the man to benefit from the fruits of women's work, including delousing, body painting, and hair plucking, as well as vegetable food and cooked food, in such a society, a bachelor is really only half a human being. In this kind of society, marriage is not something which you decide to do. It is something which automatically comes. It's like birth, marriage, death. It's a natural event, a life cycle stage. Those who do not marry are ridiculed and derided, for example, among the Todas of the Nilgiri Hills in India. Marshall writes, "Every man and every woman, every lad and every girl is somebody's husband or wife, tied at the earliest possible age." The only two major civilizations where this isn't universal are Buddhist societies of Central Asia in Tibet and other areas where celibacy is highly valued, and Christian civilizations which model themselves on their own bachelor savior, and where the medieval Catholic Church valued virginity and celibacy above all other virtues. This is, in fact, very unusual, and our own pattern of deciding, and each person deciding whether they are going to enter this state, is cross-comparatively peculiar. Equally peculiar is the age at which people marry in Western societies. Although there are some exceptions, it can generally be said that in most civilizations in the past and in the other parts of the world, people have married as soon as possible, particularly women. In extreme cases, for example, in some Australian tribes, you have infant marriages or even pre-birth marriages. People are married, the infant in the womb is married to someone. In the Todas of South India, even a boy yet unborn may become a husband of another woman. More characteristically, the mean age at marriage for women is at puberty or just before. In India, it was 14 or 15. This is to encourage childbearing and to avoid the shame and scandal of having an unmarried, yet fully mature female around in the society. Again, in our own society, we now marry characteristically in the West between 20 and 25. in the past, in the last few centuries, often the ages were even higher, 25 to 30. And this long gap of 10 years between puberty and marriage, combined with many people unmarrying, known as the European marriage pattern, is cross-comparatively strange. It has many effects, of course. It means the population grows much more slowly because you have 10 years of no marriage, and in Christian civilization this tended to mean of no childbearing. You have social and psychological effects. People who for 10 years are capable of sexual intercourse leading to children and yet are banned by the system. And hence there are theories about the frustration and the effects on the patterns of authority. This peculiarity goes with another one of Western societies, which is related to the system of how many people you marry. Now, the system of multiple marriage is one which anthropologists have been concerned with. We, in Western civilization, have tended to go for what is known as monogamy, one partner of each sex. And hence those who deviate are subject to some amount of either legal or other ostracism. As a rhyme put it, there was an old party of Lyme who married three wives at one time. When asked why the third, he replied, "One's absurd, and bigamy, sir, is a crime." Now the joke of that, of course, is that not only is bigamy a crime, but trigamy and any number above one is a crime as well. Our society only allows one male and one female to marry, but a considerable number of societies, particularly in Africa and South America, allow polygamy, that is the marriage of more than one male or more than one female. When you have several females married to one male, you call it polygyny. And if you have several males married to one female, then you have polyandry. Polygyny is very widespread. It usually tends to be confined to the richer members of a society, but it has many functions, and indeed those who are brought up in such systems often regard our own monogamous system as very peculiar and rather absurd, even the women who are sharing one man. As one woman put it in Africa in the 19th century, on hearing that a man in England could marry but one wife, several ladies exclaimed that they could not live in such a country. They could not imagine how English ladies could relish our custom. And speaking of African polygyny, the explorer and linguist Burton observes that the culture of the marriage tie is necessary among savages and barbarians, where, unlike Europe, a man's relations and connections are his only friends. Besides which, a multitude of wives ministers to his pride and affluence, his state and his pleasure. Because, in fact, in many of these societies, as you grow rich, the best thing to invest in is human beings and human relationships, and the one relationship you can really depend on is the marital relationship. So instead of accumulating houses or consumer goods or stocks and shares, you accumulate wives. The polygynous systems are quite widespread, but less common, but equally interesting, are the polyandrous systems, many or several husbands and one woman. Such systems are found particularly in the Tibetan and northern parts of India, and also in Sri Lanka and Ceylon in South America. In such systems, you often have fraternal polyandry, that is, several brothers marrying one woman. And there are various theories as to why this should occur. One frequent theory is that in societies where there are scarce resources up in the highlands of Nepal or Tibet, where you want to control the population, an efficient way of doing this is for several men to marry one woman, because the number of children the woman is going to have, of course, is limited. It doesn't matter how many husbands she has. Another theory is that where you have a mixed agricultural system, where you have pastoralism, men needing to take the herds off long distances or trading over long distances, and also a home farm in the valley, it's useful to have several brothers, one of whom will go off and do the trading and take the animals off into the high pastures, and the other brother staying with the wife at home, and you take it in turns like this. so that polyandry is functional and useful, but in fact it's a fairly uncommon system. Some societies, in fact, combine the two, and you have very complicated arrangements of polyandry and polygyny mixed together. Finally, there is the question of remarriage. Our society, the Catholics have not been very keen on remarriage, but on the whole, historically, there has been frequent remarriage in our society. And when a partner dies, anyway, you can remarry. In some societies, remarriage is absolutely forbidden. The extreme case is in some of the Indian societies, where a widow is so much forbidden from remarrying that in fact she has to be destroyed. Through the institution of suti, she jumps on or is placed on her husband's funeral pyre and is destroyed by fire with his death. Or you can go into permanent mourning, as Queen Victoria, of course, did. But in the West, traditionally, we have had remarriage and successive marriage. Many societies, in fact, forbid remarriage because it complicates things. Alternatively, they may take the other extreme solution, which is to very quickly marry the widow off to a relative. And here you have the institutions of levirate, as they're known, or sororate. In such a system, typically, a man who's married a girl, the girl dies, he's paid the bride wealth to her family, he's made that investment. The girl dies, and he adopts in another wife who is the girl's sister or another member of that group. So you get just an exchange there. In the true levirate, a man is obliged to beget the children on a dead brother's wife to the dead brother's name. And so you have institutions where women, men merge into each other's marriages. You have widow inheritance, whereby rights in a woman, both as a wife and a mother, pass to the man's dead kinsman. The final point is that marriage is based in our society on the idea that it's mainly about companionship, love, affection, and the relationship between husband and wife. In most societies, marriage is not set up for that purpose. It's set up for economic and reproductive purposes. As Maya Fortes put it, indeed, in many parts of Africa, a marriage is most regarded and properly established by the birth of the first child. It's about increasing labor through children and strengthening your kinship group.